On this episode of Still Loading, the best nonviolent video games. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Koval. For what seems to be since the birth of the medium, video games have been tied to the narrative that they cause violence. Despite how much evidence there is to prove otherwise, there is still a stigma that persists even all these years later. Today on the show, we are going to be doing our part to help continue to dispel that stigma. And joining me today is James Batchelor, who is the editor-in-chief of GamesIndustry.biz. He is a podcaster, and he is an author of a handful of books, but most recently, or I'm assuming most recently, a book called The Best Nonviolent Video Games. James, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Josh. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you for coming on. I've been looking forward to this. Sorry for a little behind the scenes for my listeners. There was a lot of like back and forth trying to figure out scheduling. So I'm happy we could finally get this to work, mainly on my end. It was a whole bunch of stuff up in the air. So thank you for setting aside some time for this. So before we even talk about the book, tell my listeners a little bit about yourself. You know, what do you do, your podcasts and all that good stuff.
My name is James. I'm a journalist in the games industry. I work for a site called GamesIndustry.biz. We're the B2B side of things, so we're a trade publication. The way it was pitched to me when I first joined is we are the Financial Times of the games industry, which it's not as like, you know, that sounds really kind of wanky, but like it kind of roughly describes what we do. We focus entirely on the business side. We're about, you know, the Microsoft Activision deal. We have been all over that. And we've been looking into like the implications on what it means for the rest of the industry. We've been looking into like the, you know, the global economic uncertainty and the impact that's having on investment and stuff, the potential impact of AI. It's very much about kind of the business of video games rather than, hey, this game's coming out and it looks awesome. Much as I would love to write that. I've been doing trade journalism in the games industry for about 17 years now. I feel like I've been doing it for seven. used to work on a magazine called Develop, which was for developers. And then before that, a magazine called MCV, which was for retailers and publishers. I've always wanted to be a games journalist. My career plan was always, I love writing, I love video games, let's do both. That's me by day. By night, I'm an author. Not the most prolific yet. I've written two books. I've written a novella called Wandless and a novel called Blow the House Down. Both are kind of urban fantasy. Wandless is kind of, so I'm getting some shameless plugs in here, but I'm going to go for it anyway because
you're by all means, you're going to get another chance at the end of the episode too.
Wandless is it's kind of a Harry Potter style story if the Muggles found out that wizards and witches lived among them and put them in.
Oh, okay. Essentially
in concentration camps.
Oh, gee.
Like, well, one,
escalated fast.
not quite as bad as that, but like basically put them in very nice prisons. One woman escapes and she is chased by the entire military, but it's not because of her powers and that's not the threat she poses. And then Blow the House Down is kind of it's an action-packed kind of darker take on fairy tales, which is basically what happens if you it comes from me sitting in the room with my sister and my wife watching Once Upon a Time and thinking this needs more car chases and gunfights. Those are the books I've written, and then the best non-violent video games is all my fiction writing on hold because I've been writing from this for the last couple of years. That's me.
I can imagine how long it took. I like looking through the book, like flipping through it, there's a lot of games that you talk about in this book, and I'm really excited to dive into this further. You talk about this at the introduction of your book, but for my listeners who don't have a copy in front of them, what made you want to write this book?
So it's going to sound really morbid, and I always worry the way I say this and it comes across, but it was inspired by the Sandy Hook shooting. In the wake of the Sandy Hook school shooting, yet again, there was the conversation of, well, you know, the killer played a lot of violent video games, therefore that must have been what pushed him into doing this. School shootings and mass shootings is a far, far more complex topic and probably not the one for this conversation. But part of that was the reaction is, you know, usually, you know, video games get the blame again. And there was a lot of kind of defense from the games industry tends to inevitably go on the defensive. As you said at the top of the show, like, there's never been any academic research that can prove, despite the years of academic studies, no one has proved the link between violence in video games and violent actions by the players. The link is just not there. One group of gamers, and I can't remember the name of the site, it's in the book. One group of gamers on a particular website, they declared a ceasefire. So they were going to say, right, we're going to show that gamers are respectful and respect the tragedy that's happened here, and that not, you know, even if violent video games played a part in this guy's motivation, it's not something that everyone who plays these games suffers from or deals with. It's not the thought process of everyone who plays these games. We're going to spend one day not playing violent video games.
And that was GamerFit Nation, by the way.
GamerFit Nation, thank you. Yes, GamerFit Nation did a ceasefire. And I thought that was really interesting, mainly because I figured just because they're not playing violent video games doesn't mean they're not going to be playing video games. Mm-hmm. There's so much more to video games than the violence that everyone goes on about. So I thought, well, what sort of games are they going to be playing? And I started thinking, I could write a list of, like, here's some recommended games for you to be playing if you're taking part in the ceasefire. If you're taking part in the ceasefire, like, here's a bunch of games that you could play that day that then, you know, means you can play games and you're not playing violent ones. And I thought, well, why do that just for one day? Why not do that every day? There's enough video games out there. I bet you could play a new non-violent game, a different non-violent game every single day. So I started a Tumblr and a Twitter non-violent game of the day. Each entry was just kind of, the Tumblr was just like there's a picture of the game, little details like, you know, what formats is available for, the developer, the publisher, the year it came out, and then just a paragraph of what it's about, and then like a link to here's where you can find more, and usually a link to like the official website or the Steam page. And then I'd share that on Twitter as well. Over time, I kind of dropped the Tumblr because it was taking a good amount of time. It was taking 15, 20 minutes just to write an entry, and then half an hour or so to actually find one. And it's like finding that time every single day is really difficult, and particularly because I write for a living during the day. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I don't want to write when I've finished. So I trimmed it down and just started doing a Twitter. And even then, like, the Twitter isn't quite every single day. Like, sometimes there's just days where I just don't get around to doing it. But I've got well over 1,200 games on there. And that's, you know, that's a fraction of the ones I found. On my spreadsheet, where I've basically got a massive spreadsheet where every time a new non-violent game is announced, or I see a trailer or something, or I see one at a show, I add it to the list. I think the last time I counted, I think it's 3,600 plus non-violent games that I haven't covered yet. And that's not counted. There are no new games being announced like every single day, every single week. And I try to catch all of these, but you can't. The number of like little indie games on like itch.io or mobile games that I haven't got on there, and I've not gone through the entire, you know, 50-year history of the video games industry. There's bound to be even more back there. So that's just 3,600 games that I have noticed. It's charting every single non-violent video game in existence is an impossible task, but I'm determined to kind of at least make a dent. And over time, I was thinking like, I'm so glad I'm doing this, but it's useful for people who follow me and follow the account, but it's not practical. If you're looking for a specific sort of game, I experimented with the Tumblr, trying to do like hashtags, so you're looking for simulation game or mobile game, etc. And I literally don't have the time or resource to do that as comprehensively as I'd want to. But I thought, wouldn't it be great to have just kind of a book like that just recommends like, here's some of the best ones, and kind of gives you, because the sort of people I want to reach with this aren't necessarily looking for me on Twitter or on Tumblr or wherever. Fortunately, a journalist I know, Chris Scullion, has been doing a number of books. I've lost count how many books he's done. He's been doing like the NES Encyclopedia, the SNES Encyclopedia, the Mega Drive Encyclopedia, books that are, here's every game that was ever released for this format.
Yeah.
And he was pitching, you saying, like, my publisher is interested in doing more gaming books. Does anyone have any ideas? And I DM'd him and I said, like, you know, I've always toyed with doing a non-violent game book. Do you think people would be interested? And he says, yeah, I think they would. I'll get you in touch. So he put me in touch with the publishers. The publishers said, yeah, absolutely, we love this idea. Originally, I was going to try and do non-violent game of the day, the book, and I was going to do it kind of calendar style. So a new game every year, and I'd, you know, every day, and I'd, like, you know, theme it. So, you know, there'd be a love story game, you know, something about romantic on Valentine's Day, and I'd try
that'd
and find
be pretty cool. I'd like one of those tearaway calendars.
Yeah, I'd love to have done something like that, and maybe one day I'll, like, kind of crowdfund a non-violent game of the day book. But they suggest, look, you know, the title will go with, because, you know, they're publishers, they know their business. Like, you're more likely to get attention with the best non-violent video games than you are non-violent game of the day. Like, the best non-violent video games, you instantly understand what that book is about. So yeah, they very kindly offered me a contract to write this book, and I spent about a year and a half writing it. I ended up starting kind of overwriting it. I was trying to get 500 games into the book, and then I realized I had a word limit, and I wanted to give each game a bit of justice. Like, I didn't want to be like, you know, three lines. Oh, this game is about this. Next one. Like, yeah, I want to give it a little bit more depth on the games, give a bit more information. So there's 300 plus games in the book. I say 300 plus because I've grouped series together. So I've not done, like, you know, FIFA 97, FIFA 98, FIFA 99. Like, you know, I've done FIFA. FIFA is one entry, but that's a lot of games. And yeah, that's how it came about. I appreciate that.
Oh man, what's different between 97 and 98?
I don't envy, like I say, Chris Scullin does these encyclopedias, and he has to do that. Like, every FIFA game that came out on a certain format, you have to explain the differences between, like, no, the point is, FIFA's a football game, people like it, that's enough. So yeah, that's how the book came about, and it came out early August, August 2nd in UK and Europe. It came out, I think it was October 2nd in the US. So it is now available in North America. It's available via there's a specific distributor that the publisher uses over there. But apologies, I can't remember the name of it. But you can also, I mean, I've got links on my Twitter, I think.
Casemate, I want to say.
Casemate, yes. So it's available from them, but then you can also buy it from Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can get an ebook version on, like, Nook or Kobo. And yes, it's out there now. Go buy it.
I definitely recommend it to everyone listening to this, and not just because I got a review copy for this episode, but because one of the things I look for when I get reached out to about different books and whatnot is I personally have to find some level of interest in it, and it's not because the ones that I don't are, like, lesser or they don't have any merit to them. It's just more or less I don't feel comfortable promoting something that I personally wouldn't find interesting myself. And this topic I found incredibly interesting because of what I said in the intro, and because of, like, what you said, where there's this never-ending dialogue and discourse over violence in video games and how it affects people and all this other stuff. I mean, what is it? One of my favorite gaming podcasts, Retronauts, years ago did an episode on this, and, like, one of the first examples they could talk about was the game Death Race from the 70s, I want to say, where you're basically running over stick figures, and there was a whole controversy about that, and talking about how it was going to, you know, make people violent, even though these are literally just, like, squares that you're driving over. But it, you know, whatever. But I think it's important to talk about this type of stuff because, like you said, games don't just revolve around violence. And in fact, the person who wrote the foreword to your book, John Romero, said the same thing, you know, just talking about how for every one of the things he talks about in the foreword is how it's almost easier to make a game based around violence than it is to do non-violence, or to make a game that is not based out of violence. So I had a question based off that, but before we get to that, for my listeners' sake as well, I don't want to I don't like to ask too many specific things about the book because I want people to go and listen to it, or specific things within the book, I should say, because I want people to go read it. But I do think it's worth asking, how did you classify what made a game violent versus non-violent?
So I've got a section of this as well at the start of the book, just to clarify, because violence is very subjective. What does and doesn't count as violence is very subjective. I found this with the Twitter account, the Tumblr account, like the amount of times, like I'd put in things like Puzzle Quest. You know, Puzzle Quest, you're matching three gems and it's technically part of a battle, but it's approximately, you know, the violence isn't depicted. It isn't shown. The gameplay is matching three gems. And people are like, well, yeah, that's violence. It's like, well, is chess violent? Chess is a proxy for combat. Is that violent? So the way I had to think very carefully about how to phrase this, because you will get people say, you know, trying to trip you up and like, actually, this is very violent, and this
pushing
violent,
up the glasses also, up the nose. You know, yeah, excuse me.
Exactly. Yeah, and you know, it may well be that someone may well have a look at my book and say, well, actually, this violates your rules. But the whole point is to show games that are not. That are not centered around violence, that aren't, doesn't necessarily mean completely devoid of violence. I've tried my absolute damnedest to make sure they are completely devoid of violence, but you know, you might have to deal with violent themes. I'm rambling here, but I'll get into examples in a minute, perhaps. My criteria for what counts as a violent game is, I tried to break it down into three parts. One is a game where you are not compelled, required, or encouraged to harm any other living thing. So shooters, obviously, instantly, you know, out. But even then, even games like, you know, Mirror's Edge, where you can get through that whole game without harming a single bad guy, you know, a single enemy, but you can also kick them off buildings. The obvious one is like, you know, anything where you don't harm any living things. Now, within that, I included cartoon violence. I've kind of kept out completely because I didn't want to cheat, but I didn't want to kind of cop out and just put in a bunch of Mario games. Like, well, you know,
exactly, yeah.
The Goombas don't die that violently, so it's not violence. It's like, yeah, actually, when you think about it, yeah, like a Goomba is crushed to death under Mario's boot. That's violent.
And technically, if you're going by the original Super Mario Brothers manual, every time you destroy a block, you're killing a civilian of the Mushroom Kingdom.
Yes, so. I love that fact. So that was rule one. Rule two was any game where you're able to commit a violent, or you're compelled, required, or encouraged to commit a violent action. So I put that in because, like, you could say, oh, well, you know, what about a game where it's just about shooting robots? That's not killing any living things, which is the stipulation of my first rule. But shooting is inherently a violent action. Boxing or martial arts in those kind of sports sort of games, like that is inherently a violent action. Mm-hmm. And then within that, I kind of include strategy games where your actions directly lead to violence. So when you're playing Civilization, you're just telling your soldier to go over there and fight that unit. You've not fought that unit. You've not killed anyone, but you have directly caused that violence.
Yes.
So that doesn't count. And then the last one was any games with graphic depictions of violence or, you know, violent actions and so forth. So the example I give, you know, a murder mystery. You can have a game that's about solving a murder mystery if it doesn't show a headless body somewhere and blood and gore and everything. Like, because the gameplay of that title would be investigation, research. You know, it'd be something a lot more cognitive. You're not taking any violent actions. If anything, you're kind of trying to find justice for action, for violence, or justice after violence, I should say. Those are my three rules, like no harm to living things, no violent actions, and no depictions of violence.
That makes sense. And I could see how this would be, it could be a tough, like a tight line to walk, because there is violence in some of the games on here, but they're not violent games. So the brief example, this is I would say more of a player thing, Roller Coaster Tycoon. Technically, if you want to, you can pick up some of the patrons of your park and drown them if you just drop them. But is the game incentivizing you to do that?
Example is The Sims. Like, so I've literally got The Sims on the cover. And as soon as I revealed the cover, I had people, but you can kill your Sims. You can kill your Sims. That's violent. And I replied, but you're not supposed to. The game is not about killing Sims. You're not encouraged, required, or compelled to kill Sims. If you killed your Sims, you did that, and you need to think about what you've done.
You sit in this corner and you think about what you've
done. Exactly.
Similarly, not related to actually doing injury to others, but Outer Wilds, one of my personal favorite games, there's not really violence in that, but if you, there are certain ways that your character dies, which is particularly violent, whether it's getting eaten by a fish, one of the I forget what they're called, or you know, I've accidentally been crushed to death by sand. That was fun.
See, but that one I included.
Oh yeah, no,
the violence is not depicted graphically.
Like exactly,
it's a first person game, and when you die, just as far as I remember, the screen just goes black. Like, it's not like there's blood splattered all over.
Yeah, no, there isn't.
And that was that's so fascinating, that game, in terms of finding a compelling loop, something that encourages people to play on without just, can you get better at killing things? Yes. I had to include that one.
No, I agree that it should be included. I think the point I was trying to make was that just because there can be violence in nonviolent games, but like you said, that's not the point of the game. Mm. It's not encouraging you to do it. In fact, if you die in a game, that's usually something a player wants to avoid. Like you said in the Sims example as well, like, you're not supposed to do that. You need to think upon your actions, type of thing. I wanted to at least bring that up because I find it interesting when some people think of nonviolent games, they might think of just straight up, you know, here's a, you know, the 50th version of Candy Crush or something like that. You know what I mean? Versus no, there's a lot of amazing games out there that are nonviolent. And that leads me to my next question. Do you personally feel like it's harder for game developers to design games with a nonviolent intent, or like to not use violence as like kind of the standard?
It is, because as John Romero says in the foreword, it's too easy. It's too easy to come up with a violent game or a game that centers around combat or conflict or something. I can never remember which developer told me this, but I was having a conversation with a developer. This was like 10, 15 years ago, long before I'd ever started doing this violent game stuff. But they were talking about violence in games, and they were saying that it was Space Invaders. Space Invaders kind of changed everything, because as soon as developers knew that if this pixel fires more pixels at another pixel and that last pixel disappears, that creates such an instant injection of endorphins, such an instant satisfaction.
Yeah.
That's the easiest way to like get a physical reaction out of your players, and that's escalated long. You know, like, it's ever since the '70s that's escalated. So that's why you've got games that are all about, you know, killing in the most stylish way possible, or killing in the quickest way, or the fastest way, or the glory of combat and the glory of winning the battles. The one man army games. I'll say at this point, this whole book and my whole thing about nonviolent games is not to decry violence at all. Like, I enjoy violent games. I enjoy violent games, but it's to show that there's so much more to it than that. And, you know, to go to your original question, like, the challenges for developers is coming up with a loop, a gameplay loop that is as compelling and enjoyable and satisfying as killing bad guys. That doesn't involve killing bad guys. And some of the examples have just been amazing. Some of the stuff I found in my book and that I've put in my book, like, brilliant. Me, Outer Wilds as a prime example. That game is entirely about exploration and learning knowledge. And you don't really kind of impact the world really at all. You just learn more about it. And the more you learn, the more ideas you get for where you might want to go next. And the more you kind of put together the pieces in your head. Another personal favorite of mine, Heaven's Vault. I'm going to try not to like drop the name of every single game in the book.
I mean, there's 300 of them. You would have a long way to go.
It would be impressive. But Heaven's Vault, Heaven's Vault's a game by a UK studio called Inkle. It is essentially an archaeology game set in a very kind of cool sci-fi universe where you're going around ancient ruins and you're trying to decipher ancient text. And the more you play, the more you recognize symbols, you start to kind of, not necessarily read and become fluent in, but you start to understand this language. And it becomes really satisfying when you work out, no, hang on, I recognize that symbol. So that must be this word. That must be this word. The context of this place means it's this. That's really satisfying. There's a real reward to working things out yourself rather than pushing a button and making a thing die. And yeah, it's exploring that, I think, is just really interesting. Also, stories, storytelling. Video games can tell stories in ways that no other medium can. I'll give another example, Her Story. Her Story, you are watching through like live action videos of a police interview with the same woman or the same actress, and you're trying to work out why she's been interviewed, what happened, what the story is, and it's true non-linear storytelling. You don't watch them in the same order as everyone else. You basically search a word. If the transcript of a video contains that word, it gives you the top five or the first five videos that contain that word. So you only, even if she says it in like 20 videos, you only get five. And as she's talking, you get ideas. Oh, I wonder what happens if I search for this. And, you know, basic example, Leo, you search murder. Okay, right. She says murder, etc. Like, does she say body? Does she say knife? Does she say weapon? And it leads you down different paths of investigation. And I'm not going to give anything away, but there are quite a few twists in it. But whereas most other storytelling devices, you know, books and films and TV, the twists come when someone, most of the time the twist comes when someone explains, aha, I've been the villain all along. The twists come when you realize. They never stop and explain, yeah, actually this means this. You yourself have interpreted it. I can't remember what it is that specifically triggered the realization, oh, this is what's going on. But I guarantee you, whatever it was is completely different to what might have triggered you to work it out or someone else. And I would have discovered that clip, that video, whatever that video clip was that made me think, oh, it's this. I will have found that in a different order than you would have done. Video games can do that. No other video game can. But again, kind of the stigma, you know, the assumption, the mainstream non-gaming perception is, yeah, but video games are just about killing things. And they're really not.
No, they aren't.
It's such a broad medium.
The two examples I always like to give as well of like non-violent video games, but like video games that are a lot more than what you would expect them to be. And I believe I'm 99% certain one of them, this one is in your book as well, but Journey.
That's definitely
there. Yep, Journey. And then there's another one. I'm going to check to see if it is here now. But The Unfinished Swan.
Yep, also in there.
That's in there as well. Yeah, The Unfinished Swan is like one of my favorite games that nobody talks about, because Giant Sparrow then went on to, I want to say, what was their sequel to it? Not sequel, but what was their next game?
I can't remember.
It's going to drive me nuts. It was pretty popular as well. I'll look it up real quick. But the Unfinished Swan is this fantastic. What Remains of Edith Finch. There we go.
Oh, yes. And that game's incredible. Now, that game I really wanted to include, but there is very direct, violent references. That game is all about people dying.
I have yet to play it. I've been meaning to for quite some time.
I'm not going to say anything. There was a particular scene in there that really affected me. I'm like, I can't, as beautiful and as stunning as this game is, I can't include this. But it is absolutely worth playing.
It's fantastic. It's one, not Edith Finch. Like I said, I haven't played it, but like Unfinished Swan, Giant Sparrow this was their first game. And I believe it was their first game. It's fantastic. It basically is like, what if a first person shooter, but instead of actually killing people, you paint a world into existence. That's like the beginning of the game. You just see a pure white screen and you can't see anything. You don't even know that the game's really started until you fidget around on the controller, because you're just kind of like putzing around and you're a little bored. And so then you start hitting buttons and you shoot this glob of paint, and all of a sudden it brings like the shapes that were actually on the screen the whole time, but you couldn't see, suddenly you can now see. It is amazing. I absolutely adore The Unfinished Swan. It's one of those games I wish more people would play, because it came out, I want to say, either the same year or the year before Journey. I think it was the same year. And Journey got all the accolades. Well-deserved, of course. But like, The Unfinished Swan, I feel like, just does not get the same amount of attention that it deserves, because it is a phenomenal game.
I agree. I absolutely loved that game. And again, you know, going back, you know, back on topic of, like, you know, the challenge of making games that are non-violent and are just as exciting, just as compelling, it's really interesting what happens if you change just that trigger action, that shooting verb, into something different. So as you say, like, the, you know, Unfinished Swan is technically, mechanically, a first person shooter, yep, but it's about traversing a space and solving puzzles rather than making things dead. Power Wash Simulator. You're shooting water at things that are dirty, and then they're not dirty and you win, and that's doing really well.
That game also has an interesting approach to storytelling that I've never seen. It's one of the best examples of environmental storytelling I've seen in a game. Have you played all the way through it?
I've not played all the way through. No, I've done like the first couple of levels.
There's bizarrely enough, there is a story. I'm not saying it's like anything groundbreaking or phenomenal. It's silly. It's campy. It's meant just to be a goof. I don't even know if it really matters, because there's not really. Do you care if I spoil it at all for you?
No,
I don't. Just listeners, if you care, skip ahead like 2 seconds. You just find out that a lot of the people ordering the jobs for you are aliens, and as you as you progress through the game, you wash off like giant temples and structures and monuments, and then they thank you and they leave. But the way that they tell this is through little like tidbits throughout the game, where there's very odd things that keep pointing to, like, why do I keep cleaning these increasingly bizarre places? Like, why am I cleaning this temple? Why am I cleaning this and this? And finally, it gets to a point where you're in the middle of a desert and you have to clean a van that's just in the middle of a desert. And then when you turn around, all of a sudden, it's a flying saucer. Like, brilliant. You see it's a van one moment, and then it's a flying saucer the next. And that's pretty much it. So, like, and by cleaning the things that they ask you to clean, you end up doing something for them. It's very silly and goofy, but the fact that it's all told just by what you're washing without any dialogue for the most part, I find really interesting and kind of impressive.
This is the thing. You can spout off one example of a non-violent game and it will trigger like 4 or 5 others in other people's minds. Like, there are just so many out there.
And I think one of the most perfect examples of one of those non-violent games that they're, like you said, and I feel like something that gets overshadowed is Portal.
Mm.
Portal is like one of the most acclaimed games of all time, but it is, unless you count the companion cube like something that's violent.
That is a normal game. That is obviously in the book. I could not include that one. And again, that's the whole, you know, you're replacing shooting with a shooting sort of based mechanic, but it's a puzzle mechanic. It's about traversal. It's about puzzle solving. The humor in those games is amazing. Those games are just, you know, that I think shows like the power a non-violent game can have. You think when it first came out on the Orange Box, the big deal about the Orange Box was, right, here's Half-Life 2, which is one of the most acclaimed games of all time at that point, and Episodes 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. And I believe it came with Team Fortress, the new Team Fortress. Which was a huge multiplayer hit. On this little experimental game called Portal. And all people could talk about after Orange Box was Portal. Like, yep, that's the one non-violent, that's the, you know, the only non-violent component to that entire game. Because Half-Life is about a mild-mannered scientist taking a crowbar and murdering aliens. Team Fortress is about getting together with your mates and murdering each other. Portal is about solving these puzzles and this deranged computer and this clever, fascinating portal technology and getting your mind to think about physics in, you know, physics and gravity in a completely different way. And that's what got everyone excited. And this is why I love it when a non-violent game really breaks out, because it's breaking out not because it's doing violence really well or combat really well, or, you know, it's just got a really nice setting for all the killing. It's because it's come up with a genuinely new gameplay idea. And there's so many out there.
I feel like that's why we were talking about before, like why it's harder for non-violent games to be made. You have to be a little bit more creative because it's like you said, it is so easy to just go with the standard, you know, the status quo. And think of how easy it would have been for Portal. You already had the first person shooter type of mechanics, but they're like, well, what if we, you know, did something different with that? What if we didn't, you weren't just shooting other people and you were shooting, you were, it was all about physics. And it's a, it's interesting because at that time, like, you never really saw a physics based first person game. It's not surprising that it came from Valve, since, you know, they kind of had the gravity gun in Half-Life 2, and that kind of started a lot of their experimentation with the physics engine they built for the game. But still, and I feel like indie games especially shine in this nonviolent area, just because there is, you don't have to worry so much about overhead and all this other stuff. You can just be creative. Like, for crying out loud, like Stardew Valley, one of the most popular and influential games of all time. No, I guess that is violent.
Unfortunately, that one does have a...
I just realized it halfway through that example.
But it's a good example. And this sort of thing, like, it's a good example of the sort of game that didn't quite make it into the book, but I would recommend people play, because it's something very different. Like, something, you know, it's something that isn't the norm, isn't the usual perception of games. There's been two things I think that have really helped the rise of nonviolent games in the last few years. I say last few years, it could be last 5 to 10. One is the rise of the indie scene. Indies are a lot more creative. They kind of need to take more risks and need to try and stand out because of the nature of you can't make an indie Call of Duty because no one's going to pay attention to it compared to Call of Duty.
Exactly.
So you have to do something different. And some of the ideas indies have come up with are incredible. The other thing is this rise of the cozy game, the wholesome game, whatever you want to call it. And that's been particularly concentrated in the last 2-3 years since Animal Crossing New Horizons really took off around the pandemic. That is the most accidentally perfectly timed release of all time.
Yep.
Like, you know, by the way, you're all going to have to stay indoors for 6 months. Here's a game that is just about creating your own little spot of paradise at a time when you cannot leave your front door. It's amazing. Like, the amount of farming sims we've seen since then and kind of riffs on the Animal Crossing sort of formula, the amount of simulation games that tap into that kind of same sort of mentality of like, hey, here's just, you know, here's a gardening sim, here's a game about nurturing things. Like, those two things, the rise of indie games and the rise of cozy games, has really pushed forward how varied video games can be. The problem is it still gets drowned out by the AAA stuff, which has got more money, more marketing budget, more attention. And the AAA side has to be risk averse because it's a hit driven business. Like, they have to, you know, you won't get, EA making a non-violent equivalent of Battlefield because Battlefield is what sells. Okay, yes, perhaps a bad example. Activision aren't suddenly going, you know, Activision were a very varied publisher at one point in terms of they were making, you know, family games like Skylanders, they were making licensed games, you know, like all the old Transformers stuff, they were making rhythm action games like Guitar Hero, they make sports-ish sort of games like Tony Hawk's, and they were making Call of Duty, and now they only make Call of Duty because that is what sells. That is what people demand, the largest audience demands. So you're not going to get Activision suddenly not doing a Call of Duty 1 year and instead making their own Portal, which is a shame, because I'd love to see what AAA could do with that sort of thing. A random example, the Assassin's Creed, they put so much time and effort into researching the world building, researching the historical period and trying to make everything authentic. They then add the discovery tour mode, which is where you go around the game world. There is no assassinating, there's no violence, there's no combat, there's nothing. It turns the game world into a virtual museum. If you sold that standalone, and they do actually sell it standalone, but like, if you sold that standalone and there was no base game of Assassin's Creed, I don't think that would do as well. But if you look at the fact that it exists, it's such an amazing educational tool. Like, schools use this to kind of teach people about ancient Egypt, ancient Greece, and the Viking era Britain. You know, it's in museums and stuff. If we had more AAA companies putting time and effort into that sort of game, but you won't. Like, the only reason that game exists is because they put time and effort into making Assassin's Creed and wanted to make more use of those assets. and that knowledge rather than specifically building it for that purpose. And I think that's a shame, but I'd love to see that change.
It's going to take a big shift in gamers' taste, because right now, I mean, granted, gamers' taste could be dictated by how much, you know, is marketed to them and all that other stuff. But your mention of Assassin's Creed, though, I wanted to ask, what was a game that surprised you on out of all the ones that you included in this book? Like, was there a game that you were surprised that actually fit into your criteria for a nonviolent game? Like Assassin's Creed, obviously. Is there any others, or do you have any other examples of that?
I don't really know. I mean, the Discovery Tour, I wasn't too surprised. The Discovery Tour, I was determined to get it out there because I think it's such a cool idea that I wanted to include it in the book. And, you know, it's a funny way to get an Assassin's Creed into there. I'm trying to think. I mean, all the games are a delightful surprise. I had that before writing the book. I knew of most of these games anyway. So it's kind of a way to kind of highlight some personal favorites.
Okay.
I can't really think of any that surprised me in that way. They're like, oh no, actually that does count as nonviolent. I do get that now, like not necessarily with the book, but with the Twitter account. Like there'll be ones like, oh, I don't know, is that going to be nonviolent? And I'll search and I'll check like the age rating and the parent reviews and stuff. And like, oh no, okay, I'm good to leave this. I tell you what, there were some, kind of the converse is there was some where you assume it's nonviolent, and actually, surprisingly, it is. The example I'll give is this. It's another Ubisoft game, The Crew. The Crew is about, it's an open world racing game set across the entirety of the United States. That's all they talked about in the marketing. That's all I haven't played The Crew, but that's all that they talked about in the marketing. That's all you'll see in the trailers is, here's this massive open world racing game. You can drive from, you know, New York to Los Angeles in one hit. It's absolutely massive. It's amazing. I posted that on the Tumblr and the Twitter account quite early on. I think it was in the first like month or two of me starting this account. And someone pointed out that literally the opening cutscene starts with a drive-by shooting. And the story is you're an undercover cop trying to take down this gang from within. It's like, I had no idea. Because they just talk about it being a racing game. It's like, so there have been somewhere. It's like, oh, no, there is violence in this, and I didn't know. I'm 99.99999% that's not the case for any of the games in the book. I'm pretty sure these are all fit within my criteria. But, so sometimes a game can surprise you that it looks violent. Stardew Valley, I thought, oh, yeah, perfect. I put that in. Oh, no, wait, you go out and kill things.
There's a lot of slime hunting.
Yeah, slime hunting is actually, ah, damn. Or like, you know, you'll get games that like, oh, you know, that game looks brilliant. Oh no, wait, hang on. It involves hunting. You're hunting rabbits and stuff for food. And it's like, that probably does count as violent. That can always be disappointing. That's always, particularly if I've been like reading up on a game for about half an hour, 45 minutes, and you would just find one reference to like, there's games honestly, where it's like, this is an amazing cutscene game, and there's a boss fight at the end. Literally just adding one boss fight at the end in an otherwise non-violent game just completely scuffers it. It's frustrating.
And it's funny because you'd think like all the violent games out there, a lot of times instead of having a boss fight, they usually have some, it's still violent. I'm not trying to say that obviously the game isn't, but like instead of like some big boss, it's like some gauntlet that you have to fight your way through. And I always find it interesting that you say there's non-violent games that are non-violent until they decided like, all right, well, we need some way to finish this, so here's a boss.
Yeah.
And then other games that are violent are like, well, we need some way to finish this, let's not do a boss, and let's do, bosses are hard though, it's hard to design bosses. I feel like that's underratedly difficult, I don't know if that's the right way to phrase that, but a difficult part, perhaps. There we go, underappreciated part of game design, where it's hard to make it is hard to design a boss, because bosses ideally should test the mechanics that the game has taught you and that you have practiced throughout however long you've played, but that's not always the case.
I understand the need, like you need some sort of final set piece to like conclude your game. You need a climax. You need a grand finale. And the vast majority of stories in games, I guess, I would argue involve or boil down to some sort of conflict. And the best way to resolve that conflict, or perhaps the easiest way to resolve that conflict,
is to remove
the thing that you're conflicting against. Like the example I'll give is, this one didn't make it into the book purely because of the boss fight, Donut County. Donut County is a game just about making a holes that drop things into, like, you know, the dark underground, and the more things you drop in, the hole grows bigger, and the idea is to suck up everything within a level, and then you move on to the next stage. But then by the end, it's some sort of spoiler alert for Donut County, apologies, but I think it boils down, it's something about like a trash stealing raccoon is trying to take over the world or something, and you end up basically moving your hole to catch the bombs that it throws from its it's in some sort of war plane ship.
Interesting.
Thing, war, okay. Robot, and you catch the bombs in your hole and shoot them back to blow up the robot. It's like, and I get it works for that game. It works to have like this just last boss fight of like, here's the end. Otherwise, it's just another riff on the same level you've been playing for so long, and that wouldn't really be a grand finale. But it does automatically mean I couldn't include it in the book.
I could see that's frustrating too. When you, I don't know, I understand why they do it, but yeah, that's kind of a bummer, because I feel like there's a lot of games that are just this close to being like, I mean, technically, even like Stardew Valley, I don't think it would be as good without the mine element, but technically you don't need that element, but it is still a major part of the game nonetheless. But I guess that's just, you know, Harvest Moon or Animal Crossing sort of at that point. Kind of tying in all this talk of nonviolent games to what you do as a journalist, do you ever feel like there is a difference in how game publishers market their violent games versus their nonviolent? Obviously, you know, your big AAA Call of Duties, but I'm talking about more or less the ones that kind of do a little mixture of both. Do you feel like there is a difference in the way that they approach marketing them?
Oh, massively. And it's something that frustrates me as a gamer. So the example I'd give for this is immersive sims, so things like Deathloop and Dishonored. Those games, you can get through them, and in fact you get an achievement or a trophy for doing so. You can get through them without killing a single person. You know, Dishonored, every single assassination, there is a non-violent, non-lethal alternative to it. I am a massive fan of stealth games. I love playing games stealthily. Those games I sneak through. I don't ever do any of the chaos things. I am all about sneaking through, not being seen, you know, ideally getting through an entire level without anyone knowing I was there. But that doesn't make for a good trailer. That doesn't make for a good sizzle reel, which is why you get these cool, you know, montages of someone like freezing time and stabbing someone in the neck and then running over and catching a grenade and throwing it back to the person who put it there, is like, because that looks cooler, that's easier to sell.
Anytime
that there's any game that lets you play violently and non-violently, or violently or non-violently, they will always lean into the violence and the combat to sell it. And it's just because it's the nature of marketing. Like, it's easier to sell action than it is to sell sneaking.
I make sense, because that's like with action, you can see the visceral, like it's much more visceral, right? Yeah. You can see everything right in front of you. With stealth, how do you market an emotion?
Yeah.
You know, because that's what you're getting out of that. You're getting a sensation of like of one upping, you know, how do you feel? You feel, I don't know, for me, I can't speak for everyone who plays stealth games. So when I'm able to sneak around somebody or take them out nonviolently or not have to use any lethal means and I can just sneak around, I get a sense of almost like not superiority. That makes it sound really high and mighty, but it's kind of in a similar vein to
it's
that.
Power. It's power, isn't it? Like I my favorite game of all time is Thief 2, The Metal Age. And okay. I remember my very, very, very first gig My very first gig as a games journalist was, I did a week of work experience on PC Gamer in the UK. And I was talking to members of the team, and they were saying, you know, any games you'd particularly want to write about. And I said, I'm absolutely obsessed with Thief. And so, well, look, we've got this feature that we do, like looking about why a game is particularly satisfying, or do you want to try writing a version of that? It didn't get published. It was just kind of a writing exercise. And I couldn't quite articulate my thoughts at that point because I was still very early as a journalist. And one of the members of the team helped me. He's like, what you're trying to get at is it's the power fantasy. It's not power fantasy in terms of I am so powerful, because you're not. You're underpowered. Like, typically in stealth games, one hit from a bad guy and you're dead. And like, if you end up in combat. But it's the power of knowing that you have a power over your enemies, in that they don't know where you are. They don't know what you're going to do. They can't stop you from doing it. because they are so unaware. That's so satisfying. There's a real smugness to that. But yeah, you're right. You can't get that emotion through in a 2-minute trailer or a 1-minute trailer.
Not without being super cheesy. Just I'm picturing like a really like cheesy sketch of just some guy smirk and be like, look what I did there. He didn't even see it coming type of thing.
I think the closest you could get to that would be if you know, like the Batman Arkham games or Spider-Man, where you can do like the drop down, take down, where you suddenly drop down, tie them up and take them out of the picture, like the bad guy out of the picture. Yeah. But even then, that's like a brief 2-second moment in a trailer that still got to be filled with all the other, you know, fighting and combat and stuff.
It's got to be so hard to market. Now, on the opposite side, on the game journalism side, do you find any difference? Not trying to, you don't have to list anything for gamesindustry.biz. I don't want to throw your publication under the bus or anything, but do you notice in other publications, without giving even names, because I don't want any enemies, but like, do you notice a difference in how they approach writing about non-violent games versus violent games?
I think actually, like, this may be just my perception, but I think there's a bit of fatigue within the games media of all these hyper-violent action-centric games. I think journalists are chomping at the bit to write about interesting non-violent titles, particularly from indies, but even more so if it's from like a proper AAA company. I say, hey, look at this cool thing that's never been done before. Like, journalists are desperate to share these alternatives. It's why why you see, like, you saw so many journalists getting behind Euro Truck Simulator 2 and talking about the satisfaction of just driving around and delivering cargo, like, because it's so different. It breaks up the, because it gets quite monotonous seeing how many violent games are out there. And then I've never been the consumer side, so I've never had to like preview or review games. Certainly not. I've done it here and there on a freelance basis, but not on a regular basis. I imagine it must get quite boring, you know, reviewing the Call of Duty every year, or, you know, reviewing all the, you know, when you watch the Jeff Keighley Summer Games Fest events, and like there was, I think there was one like a couple of years ago where like, I think 5 titles in there were on the lines of basically Dead Spaces. There was like the Callisto Protocol, the Dead Space remake, and then 3 other titles that if you merged the trailers together, you could not tell the difference between any of them. It's the whole, you're on a space station on your own with lots of aliens, kill them in the bloodiest way possible to survive. And the amount of journalists I know who are just like, I am so bored of this. There needs to be something more interesting. So I think journalists, the way they approach it, like, journalists are really keen to share these non-violent games and share these kind of alternatives because they want to show that video games are so much more than the typical violence and typical action you tend to see.
I could see that. I don't blame them either. I mean, that one of the things I think that's, this is tangentially tied to like, you know, what, like, why I pick certain books to cover on the podcast here is because if it's the same stuff over and over and over again, it's not nearly, it gets dull and boring. Like, I always try to find stuff that I find interesting or that I don't think it's like talked about enough type of thing. And nonviolent video games really falls into that. And I feel like there's so many examples of just really innovative, interesting games that just don't get the credit they deserve because they just don't get the marketing budget behind them. In all honesty, Outer Wilds that we mentioned before is a good example of that. That's a better marketed one because it won some awards. It won some awards. It won a BAFTA. I believe it like took home Game of the Year at the BAFTAs a year or two ago. But at the same time, like, if you talk to anybody outside of kind of like this either indie game sphere or just like a gaming in general, they probably don't know much about it, if at all. And it's a bummer because there's a lot of great stuff out there, not just Outer Wilds. In fact, like, looking through your book, I don't know if I'm going to buy it yet because I got to save money, but it's only $5. There's a game that you talked about on here called Townscaper, which I had never heard of. Yeah. And the visuals alone just really stuck out to me. It's like a painting that you can start creating and scaping this kind of almost steampunk-esque city. It's a city building game, which I think is just really interesting and really cool, and the visuals are really fun to look at. And I feel like this book that you've written is a really great way to advertise some of these games, because they just don't get the credit that they do, that they should otherwise. And don't get me wrong, there's still a lot of popular games in here, like Rock Band and Rocksmith and all that other stuff. But then there's so many interesting games that I've never even heard of that just kind of scream, that I shouldn't say scream, but they're just like super interesting to me. Like Unraffle, I had never heard of that. Came out in 2016. It looks really interesting. So I don't know. I've enjoyed like skimming through this.
That's been my hope. Is I had to kind of get in like the obvious ones. So, yeah, like, it'd be really weird if I didn't include like FIFA, Just Dance, The Sims, etc.
Yeah,
but I really did want to include a good variety of games that people might not have discovered. And like I think I say it in my intro, I quietly hope. Yeah, I'm not gonna pick myself up to think that this is going to, I've created this incredible discovery vehicle that's going to change the industry. But yeah, really to read a basis, like my ideal is if someone discovers a game in that book that they didn't know about, that they think they might like to try, and they try it and it becomes a new favorite of theirs, that would be amazing. And I've actually had a couple of messages from people like, I had no idea about this one, but I absolutely love it. I'm really enjoying playing this. Like, I've had people message me say, your book reminded me of a game I've really enjoyed before, and I've actually paid and I've re-downloaded it, re-bought it to rediscover it, and I've also tried these others. It is kind of what I want. I want to help people broaden their horizons a bit and try something new, try something that they wouldn't have done before.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can find I have to confess, I don't play as many indie games as I should or as I'd like to. Like, as much as I think more than half the book is indie games. Like, there are plenty in the game in the book that I haven't played myself. I've researched them as thoroughly as I can. I've watched Let's Plays. I've took the developers. I've made sure that they fit the criteria. But it's impossible for me to play 300 plus games in the space of 2 years and make sure that they're all absolutely amazing. But there are games in there that, like, I tried on a whim. Heaven's Vault. Going back to Heaven's Vault. The only reason I tried that one is because I like 80 Days, which is by the same studio. 80 Days is by the same studio. I really enjoy that. 80 Days is kind of a text adventure
built
on the Around the World in 80 Days by Jules Verne. And it's kind of a steampunk take on it, and it's a really, really fascinating text adventure. And they then did Heaven's Vault. It's like, well, I really enjoyed 80 Days. I'll give that one a go. And I honestly, I'm back and forth as to which one I prefer, because Heaven's Vault was such an amazing, incredible game that I'd never tried. So yeah, I just want people to try something different.
And I can tell you, at least from my own personal experience, I'm going to be trying something different. I'm really tempted to pick up that Townscaper game and
it's so chill. Townscape is really relaxing and chilled out. There's no objective. There's no time limit. There's literally just, can you build a town? There's no resource limits or anything. It's like literally, what sort of coastal island town can you build? And her story, I absolutely recommend. That's superb.
Her story, it's funny, I actually interviewed the composer to its spiritual sequel, Telling Lies. Nanita Desai, who she's done a bunch of stuff, but I interviewed her because she did the music for that, and I think since she's done another game recently that's been pretty popular. Anyway, I have two other questions for you about the book before we start wrapping up. One, what is your personal favorite, or one of your favorite, I shouldn't say personal favorite because there's over 300. That's asking a lot to narrow that down. But one of your personal favorite games that you've covered in the book.
We've already mentioned some of them. 80 Days, Heaven's Vault, Journey, The Unfinished Swan. Outer Worlds was amazing. I don't think I got all the way through that. Florence is another amazing one. Florence is a mobile game by one of the designers of Monument Valley. It is a love story, and it is told entirely through, there's like no dialogue in it. It's told entirely through mini games, kind of like WarioWare. WarioWare, like the mini games are like so short. They're like micro games. And it tells the story of a whole relationship with just through these mechanics. And you start off like, just at the teeth brushing level, the mini game at the start, and you're just brushing her teeth as she goes about, before she starts her day. The mini games also become metaphors. This is incredible. I love this stuff. It's so the example is like when you're following Florence, the main character, and when she meets her partner, I can't remember his name, they go on a date, they're sitting in a restaurant, and the mini game in that date section is you're piecing together puzzle pieces that become speech bubbles. So speech bubbles are broken into different parts and you put them together. To begin with, the speech bubbles are made up of lots of different parts, but as you progress, it becomes fewer and fewer parts. So it might start off at like 5 parts per speech bubble, then it's like 4, then it's 2, and then you're just putting speech bubbles in place. And it's a metaphor for how easy conversation becomes. When you're first starting to talk to someone, you're trying to think about what to say, you're trying to think about how to get yourself across, and if you're with the right person, it just becomes natural and the conversation just flows. Yeah. It's such a clever idea. The game is like, it's like £5 on mobile. It takes 40 minutes to play. So you can do it in one sitting and it's just beautiful. So yeah, that's another favorite of mine.
I've been really enjoying exploring some of the stuff on mobile because for years I've kind of shunned mobile games away. And Monument Valley is a prime example of a game that so good. It is such a great game that does not get the love it deserves. Well, it actually does. It's been critically acclaimed. But I feel like because of the perception of mobile gaming, because of the whole freemium model that's been so pervasive, a lot of people miss out on a lot of amazing games. I recently, the time this comes out, this episode I was on will have already been out. I did an episode on my friend Jala on her podcast, Jala Chan's Place, where we were talking about these two mobile games, well, three mobile games called Simulacra, which was a super... Have you ever heard of those?
I've heard the name. I couldn't tell you what they are.
It's a found phone horror game. Definitely wouldn't fit for the nonviolent book because there is some... maybe the first game, but the second one, though, there's like violent imagery and stuff like that. But the whole premise of it is that, at least in the first game, you find this girl's phone and you find out this girl is missing. So you have to search through her phone to figure out like what happened to her. And it's interesting because it does raise the ethical, ramifications of like you, a stranger, searching through another stranger's phone type of thing. So they talk about that. They talk about like it's interesting. And each game really seems to focus on a different aspect of your life on the internet, like how you present yourself online, and each game really seems to focus on a different aspect of almost internet culture, sort of, but not in a very direct way. It's interesting. It's made by a studio, I want to say in Malaysia, and there's like live action acting, and it's a little cheesy at times, but I really admire what they tried to do with it. It was interesting. I'm not saying it's like amazing, but I had a good time with it, at least the first two. But yeah. All right. Last question before we go into our wrap ups. If you could see any of these nonviolent games that maybe got only a one off, only existed as a single game, and if you could see any one of those become a series, which would it be?
Oh, now you're asking.
That's right. The hard hitting questions here over on Still Learning.
I'm trying to think. I think I still lean towards Heaven's Vault. The translation mechanic, the interpretation mechanic is such an amazing idea. And even by the end of that game, there are so many questions about the world in which it's set. I would love to kind of like, have a series of games where you learn more and more about this universe and still just focusing on that translation mechanic. I would love to see more of that.
I have to try out this game now. Then you've been praising it the entire time, so I really need to give this a shot. And let me see, what is it? Is it for mobile or can you get it on PC?
No, it's console. It's PC, Switch, PS4. Okay. I'm not sure if it's on Xbox, but it's definitely PlayStation, PC, and Switch.
Okay, cool. I'll have to check it out. So that is Heaven's Vault. I'll have to look into that. So couple wrap-up questions for you before we sign off. I end all my interviews with two types of questions. One, huge fan of Alan Alda's podcast called Clear and Vivid, where it's all about communication. And he ends each of his episodes with where he asks his guests, there are 7 questions and 7 quick responses. I'm not going to ask you all 7 questions. Don't worry. Just picking one of them. And one of the questions that he asks is, which book changed your life?
Fantastic Mr. Fox by Roald Dahl.
Really? Okay. Yeah.
It's a children's book. I can't remember if I read it or was read it. My parents read it to me.
Yeah.
But by the age I read this one or had it read to me, most books ended with kind of, and they lived happily ever after.
Mm-hmm.
And that book kind of does, but spoiler alert for like a decades old children's book, the farmers who are hunting Fantastic Mr. Fox are still out there, and he's still got this tunnel to their farm so he can still supply his family with food and stuff. And it was the first book I'd read where the story doesn't end there, like it's still going on after this. And that fascinated me, and that is what inspired me to become a writer. I loved the idea of writing stories where they continue after the end. And so that book put me on the path to become an author.
I love that answer. I love all the different responses I've gotten to this. Some people have said The Hobbit. Other people have said, I'm trying to think. I forget what. I think actually I've only asked like one other person. I can't remember what it was, but I love that answer. I don't think I have a. Now it's actually making me think like what would be mine. But I'll answer that some other day. The last question I have for you is a segment of the show called Questions from Courtney. Courtney is my wife, and she famously, to my listeners, does not like video games, does not like anime or geek culture. I shouldn't say she likes some geek culture stuff, but in general, she's not big into games. So I always ask her, she doesn't know anything about the guests that I have on for my interviews. So I always ask her to provide me with a question that the first thing that pops in her mind. And so the question she came up with this one for you, James, is what is the best Halloween candy and what is the worst?
We're not as big on Halloween over
here.
We don't have Halloween specific candy.
We'll go with general candy then. Best candy, and then like what? The most if you were to be you're somewhere and someone has a bucket of candy, or like you're candy they're just giving out to people, and you're given this and you're like, oh my god, why did it have to be this? Your least favorite, like what would it be?
I'm going to keep it relatively Halloween themed. For best would be the Cadbury Scream Egg. Cadbury's do a cream, I don't know if you have them over there, cream egg. It's basically a small chocolate egg about the size of an egg, and it's just filled with this delicious sugary cream. They only come out in Easter, but then they've now started doing the Halloween scream egg, so it's a second dip at getting a cream egg every year. Worst candy, anything with nuts. Fucking hate nuts. Anything that's got a really strong nutty flavor, god no. Snickers.
Really? So like peanut butter stuff, no?
Yeah, anything peanut butter, yeah. Reese's can get out.
You're killing me.
Get out. No.
Oh, Reese's, even though it's not real peanut butter.
I basically stock, every time I go over to America for work, I basically buy like massive bag of Reese's for the wife because I hate it. And I was like, no. Here you go. Here's enough peanut chocolate to keep you going. No.
Leave me alone with this. Don't make me eat it. But all right, well, that's all I got for you for this episode, James. Thank you so much for joining me, man. This was a really wonderful conversation. I'm so happy to talk about your book, and hopefully this will encourage some of my listeners to go check it out. I really enjoyed learning about some of these games, and like I mentioned before, I do actually intend to check out Townscaper just because it seems so interesting. So there's lots of interesting games that for you listeners out there, if there's games that you're tired of the normal stuff, there's lots of interesting options in James's book here. There's just so many interesting and unique ideas, and I kind of excited to check out some of these. So James, where can the good people find you online, and obviously you want to promote your book, but anything you'd like to promote, you can feel free to shout out your book or any of your previous books, anything at all. So where can people find you and what would you like to promote?
So links to this book and the other books I've written are at jamesbatchelor.me. That's my website. And you can please follow the Nonviolent Game of the Day account at NVGOTD on Twitter. And I have just started doing it on Blue Sky, if anyone's on Blue Sky. I think I'll keep my shameless plugs to there. But yeah, so jamesbatchelor.me is where to find links to the book and then the Nonviolent Game of the Day account on social media.
All right. As for myself, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Still Loading Pod on all of them. Also, Blue Sky and Threads. I keep forgetting. I'm so used to the normal spiel. At Still Loading Pod, pretty much everywhere. Twitch, Instagram, Twitter, because I refuse to call it the other thing. And Blue Sky and Threads, all that good stuff. At Still Loading Podcast on YouTube. You can find me there. If you want to support the show, please consider giving it a 5-star rating or review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use, because it makes me feel warm and fuzzy. And hopefully, I don't know, I'm so confused with the algorithm rules now, but if it helps with the algorithm, that's awesome. But even if it doesn't, it makes me feel warm and fuzzy. So please consider doing that. You can also support the show monetarily by going to patreon.com/stillloadingpod for $1 a month. You'll get all the episodes a few days earlier with better audio quality, as well as access to a patron voting rights to pick future topics for the show. We do that quarterly. For $4 a month, you'll get everything I mentioned prior, plus access to 2 mini bonus episodes. And then for $5 a month, you get everything that I mentioned prior, and as well as access to Still Bonding, which is my monthly James Bond podcast where me and a bunch of friends bond over 007. And that has been going on for over a year now. There is a lot of episodes, 14 episodes, I think, at this point. All of them are at least 2.5 hours. The most recent ones have been 3 to 3.5. So lots of content for you there for $5 a month. That's all it is. And that will, once Bond is over, I'll probably pick another movie franchise and we'll just continue on and find some other stupid pun with my podcast name. Instead of Still Bonding, it'll be like Still Something Else. So who knows? We'll see where that goes. But anyway, that's all the time I have for you for this episode of Still Loading. Thank you all so much for listening. James, thank you once again, man, for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been brilliant. Really enjoyed this.
Thank you. And with all that said, listeners, I will see you all next time.